Good morning. This is Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Vincent Intondi, author of the book African Americans Against the Bomb: Nuclear Weapons, Colonialism, and the Black Freedom Movement. Dr. Intondi is the executive director of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and a research scholar at Cornell University REPI Institute for Peace and Conflict Studies. He also has more than 20 years of grassroots organizing, academic, and NGO experience. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, Dr. Vincent Intondi.
Thank you so much for having me.
You make the point pretty early on in your book that the outsider status of Black Americans may have made them more critical of atomic weapons. Now, I can imagine that being outsiders, that is a repressed population, might make them more interested in embracing the prevailing narratives of the society in which they find themselves. But you're saying the opposite. Did you unearth actual evidence that they were more critical? And as a historian, can you explain that effect of the outsider status?
Sure, thank you. Yeah, so if we go all the way back to 1945, when the bomb was first dropped, for African Americans, think about leading up to that point, especially if we're going to look at World War II, and we're talking about a segregated military, we're talking about internment, and they were seeing another group of people that committed no crimes, but were being put in these outdoor prisons for just for the color of their skin. Of course, segregation and Jim Crow. And so all of this was happening. So there was not this feeling of necessarily, you know, patriotism or nationalism in the way that kind of the majority of the American public was feeling. Now, of course, nothing's monolithic. So after Pearl Harbor, there was a split in the Black community. Some were saying that, you know, we need to be all in and support the war effort. Others were not looking at it that way. And in terms of the kind of outsider status, also remember that in the Black community, so much, especially in the Black press, took an international point of view or was looking at things in an international lens. And I mentioned that because of how important Italy's invasion of Ethiopia was in 1935. When that happened, there were so many pro-Ethiopian groups in the United States. This also affected Black churches, Black civil rights leaders. And so they were asking the United States to step in and help them and help the Ethiopian people. And that wasn't the case. And in fact, it was the Japanese that came out publicly and said, we are going to come to the aid of our colored brothers and sisters in Ethiopia and send them weapons. And so everything from Japanese internment to the Italian invasion of Ethiopia, there were things that were already happening before the bomb was ever dropped that made them, you know, kind of already set up that critical stance. And then lastly, when the bomb is dropped, what I found was inside the Black community, you had artists and musicians and journalists and pastors that before any organized peace movement or before any evidence was out, were immediately looking at the dropping of the bomb through the lens of race and colonialism, asking Langston Hughes, of course, famously being the first to ask the question, why did we not drop it on Germany? Why did we not drop it on Italy? Why do we drop it on a people of color? And starting to connect, make those connections. You know, Paul Robeson, I found one of the first to ask the question of, you know, where did we get the uranium to drop the atomic bombs and to build them? And of course, the answer was the Belgian-controlled Congo. And so they immediately started making those connections then with colonialism as well.
Well, I'm glad you raised Paul Robeson and another Black radical of that era would be W.E.B. Du Bois. And I'm interested in their perspective because a lot of the opposition to the bomb in both the Black and white communities over the years hinged on a guns versus butter argument, which has its merits, but it's a pretty shallow critique. So Paul Robeson and Du Bois were, as you said, linking the bomb to racism and colonialism. And I'd just like you to flesh out the arguments that they were making at that time.
Yeah, so part of it dovetailed with the Korean War. So when the Korean War breaks out, there is, think about what's happening. You have we're on the heels of the civil rights movement now in the early 1950s, and you have we've already watched seen the dropping of the bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We're testing more nuclear weapons, and now with Korea, it but we're threatening again. Verbally threatening our president to use nuclear weapons in Korea. And so for Robeson and Du Bois and others, they were saying, we can't sit idly by and let another Hiroshima happen in Korea to another people of color. We can't allow this to happen. And so they were also far left, people would say they were they communists? No, they weren't communists, but they were certainly left-leaning, and they were in the black, what's called the Black Popular Front groups. And so they knew what was going on in Europe, and there was a movement against the bomb from the communist bloc nations in the early 1950s that they gravitated towards, and brought the Ban the Bomb pledge back to the United States. And they were, Du Bois was lionized in Asia. He was writing about his trips in Asia when he was for the Black Press, the Chicago Defender, the Pittsburgh Courier, and he was saying what has happened didn't just happen to Japan. It's going to set back the progress of quote colored nations for decades to come. So they were looking at it in a much larger diaspora, a larger, Pan-African context that others weren't, and paid dearly for it. Paid dearly with McCarthyism and HUAC. I mean, they really, their lives were destroyed because of their stance, but they didn't look at peace as a bargaining chip in the way that the NAACP did, because at the same time, here was Truman, President Truman, running for re-election, and he's running against Henry Wallace, the former vice president, on the Progressive Party ticket, and he's to the left of him, and to the right, he had Thomas Dewey. And he, at the last second, throws a Hail Mary and pledges that if he gets elected, he's going to have this giant civil rights package put forward. And the NAACP made a decision to take a hard shift to the right and ally themselves with Truman in hopes of getting the civil rights package. And other groups also did the same thing. They wanted to, because at that time, to be anti-nuclear was now synonymous with being pro-communist. And the worst label you could get, and this happens to Du Bois and Robeson, is to be black and red. But they refused to bow. They refused to kowtow to this, and again, it paid for it. So they just looked at things in a different lens than others were.
Well, I want to. We might come back to the McCarthy era because it's that dynamic of being labeled as a commie. I think that's not when you're a peace activist, I think is not limited to that era. But there's frequent mention made in the various black radicals or liberals that you quote in your book to the seeds underlying the problems of militarism or the bomb, the roots of the problem. I was curious about whether the market economy came up as a one of those underlying issues that was driving militarism and imperialism and just plain old colonialism abroad.
Sure, absolutely. You can't really take away capitalism and our economy and the role it played in our, US military. But then also, oftentimes, what we see is, going back to the 60s, is to develop and to create and produce and test these nuclear weapons, where is the money coming from? It's not coming from, taxing rich corporations, it's coming from cutting millions upon millions of dollars of social programs that benefited the poor. And all the way back to Dr. King, even before him, they were saying, look where this money could be better spent. And here we are spending it, we're the ones that are getting hurt in this. So again,
Yeah,
they were,
that's the guns versus butter argument.
yeah, they're looking at the money issue and saying, that we're losing all of these programs that help us, so that we can, bomb other countries. And then what you have on top of that is here, and this is again something that I think is specific somewhat to the Black community during this, is we're supposed to be creating this image abroad of we have the moral high ground. Look at us. We can possess nuclear weapons because we're not crazy to use them. We know exactly what we're doing. And yet other countries are putting pictures in their paper of dogs attacking African Americans and Bull Connor, and all of these things, saying, you're going to lecture us about human rights. You're going to lecture us about when and how nuclear weapons should be used. And the other piece is that for many in the Black community, the use of nuclear weapons on a people of color, threatening to use them on a people of color, testing them on a people of color, is a further extension of just violence against people of color. So whether it is police brutality, whether it is larger scale things of whether it's nuclear, again, nuclear testing or use of nuclear weapons, whether it's conventional weapons, it is this idea of just violence being okay against people of color. And it shows just an utter contempt for many cases, Black life. And so that's something that is, a thread throughout this whole thing. They don't, again, I want to stress nothing's monolithic, but what I found is that, like the Black Freedom Movement, it is a long movement that starts when the first slave ship arrives and is still going on today. This is part of it. This is part of that movement. It's not compartmentalized over here in some separate thing. Many of these leaders saw the issue of peace and the issue of civil rights or racial equality as links in the same chain, not separate issues. But again, there were others that thought they absolutely should be separate, for a variety of reasons.
Now that you've brought it up, I'm curious to ask you about why the peace activism within the civil rights movement was not, hasn't been particularly recognized by historians of the civil rights movement.
Again, these are siloed. And so what you have is, I mean, when I started this research, I was told repeatedly by scholars in both the African American history and Black studies space, and then also the peace space, that I was going to find nothing, that African Americans at the Black community were too busy fighting for their own civil rights, and this was a white middle class issue. And, they were wrong. And so part of it is just who is writing and researching the scholarship. The other is how this has been perceived for so long. When you have a narrative for so long as being one thing, it kind of just gets embedded in. And the other thing is the internal racism that was in many predominantly white peace organizations. And so there were Black organizations or African Americans that said, we care about the same issues, but we're not going to operate within that space. We'll do our own thing. And that's what was the case with a group like Blacks Against Nukes, where, here was this Black librarian from Georgetown and his wife, and they care desperately about this issue. They reach out to all these white organizations who say, nah, your area, your community doesn't care. And so they say, forget it. We'll start our own group, Blacks Against Nukes. One flyer, one rotary phone, a fax machine, and hundreds of members, and they're featured in the news, and and they weren't the only ones that were trying to find a place for them in here and couldn't. And so it's that kind of, secret that nobody wants to talk about when we think of activist or grassroots organizations or nonprofit organizations that all seem to be on the right side of the issue. What we don't want to admit is the misogyny and the homophobia and the racism that plagues these organizations and has for so long, and in many cases still does. And that's a conversation that we desperately need to have.
Yeah, so white radicals, of course, were making many of the same arguments that Black radicals were making, but I would understand from what you just said that there weren't significant differences necessarily in how they understood the problem, or were there?
The issue is more in strategy. So a couple of things. One, in understanding the problem with many of the predominantly white peace activist groups, they looked at it simply as an issue of peace. They didn't want to tie it to race. To them, if you bring race into this, it muddies the waters. You get into certain things we don't want to discuss. This is just simply a peace issue. We don't want to tie it to colonialism and to race. Where the Black community was saying, how can you not tie these things together? So that was one thing, just how you view the problem. The second thing is strategy, which is in many cases, there were African Americans that wanted to be much more direct in terms of civil disobedience and things like that. One that comes to mind is Byron Rustin. Byron Rustin, the gay civil rights leader, who, another one that's been marginalized in our history. But he wanted to be much more over. He talked about with white groups, he said, we should renounce our US citizenship. We should go put our bodies on the line physically to try to stop testing in Africa or with Russia. And he wanted to do a lot of these things that there was just no appetite for in the white community. It was many of them was a very passive, patient, very much like the milquetoast kind of abolitionists versus the radicals that wanted to, really just join up with Nat Turner. Like the difference is there. And we see the same thing through the civil rights movement. So that was another piece of this. Now, as I mentioned, Rustin, though, a thing to remember is there were those very well-known folks in the black community that did not want him doing this. And again, one that comes to mind is A. Philip Randolph of the Sleeping Car Porters. A. Philip Randolph, when Bayard Rustin decides to create a team of British and African activists and go to Africa to try to stop the French government from testing their first nuclear weapon in the Sahara, he is saying, this is the most significant work that I've ever done. I finally see how these things are all connected. And Randolph, A. Philip Randolph, was writing letters to him saying, what are you doing in Africa? We are trying to organize to the primaries with John Kennedy. We're trying to organize over here in the civil rights movement. You're off trying to stop nuclear tests in Africa. No, again, there wasn't always this kumbaya of everybody agreeing on that. And in fact, there's a in the Bayard Rustin film, the movie, there's one, I wanted to see what happened. There's one sign in the whole film in the back where he's in a meeting that says like end nuclear war. And you're like, okay, they have one sign. And at one point he says, Colm Domingo, the actor, says something about wanting to protest and is going to protest nuclear war. And one of the other civil rights leaders says, you just go where the white man tells you to go. And he says, I go where I'm needed. And so that's the only time they really address it in that film. So it wasn't in an agreement at every stage of this. And the crazy thing with Rustin is just another little fact about him is, as Rustin, who was so prominently on the left, as Rustin goes on in age and in experience, by the time the Vietnam War comes, he actually is flipped and he becomes very anti-communist. And so when Dr. King comes out against nuclear weapons in the Vietnam War, one of his biggest opponents and critics is Rustin at that time. So their views actually get inverted with the Vietnam War, which is fascinating.
Yeah, and I'm glad you've dragged us into the 60s and 70s now. I was curious as well about Malcolm X or the Black Panthers and where they stood on the issue of nuclear weapons.
So Malcolm X, the one story I have in there of Malcolm, about Malcolm X in the book, was the first thing that I found about any of this. This is what started it. So for me, I had no idea. You don't want to, as a historian, don't want to obviously cherry pick the research. You don't want to lead it. You want it to lead you. So I literally had no idea what I would find. Maybe I would be writing a book that there was no response. The first thing I find is this story about Malcolm X, which in June of 1964, there's a group of atomic bomb survivors, Habaksha, and peace activists on a world peace study mission traveling the world. And when they come to New York, when they come to the United States, the woman that put it all, that was organizing their trip, was Yuri Kachiyama, the amazing Japanese American activist who was very close friends with Malcolm X. In fact, if you see the photo when Malcolm is assassinated, she's actually on stage holding his head. I mean, they were very close. And so Yuri Kachiyama asked the survivors, while you're here in the United States, what would you like to do the most? And they all said, meet Malcolm X. But Malcolm at the time was traveling through the Middle East and through Africa. And she writes some letters, not knowing if he even got them. And the last day, she's having a reception for them at her apartment in Harlem. And there's a knock at the door, and it was Malcolm. And Malcolm spent the day with the atomic bomb survivors. And he said, the bomb that hit us was racism. The bomb that hit you was the atomic bomb. And he talked about the Vietnam War and nuclear weapons and colonialism and racism and how these things are all inextricably linked. I mean, he understood what so many before him understood, that the issue really wasn't civil rights, the issue was human rights. I mean, that was where he was going at the end of his life. He was viewing things as in an international framework. And that's, the Panthers were very much influenced by Malcolm X's teachings. And so the Panthers, if you read Executive Mandate Number One, which Bobby Seale reads at in Oakland at, or in Sacramento outside the courthouse in 1967, and it says right in Executive Mandate Number One, it references a comparison of the Japanese internment camps and the dropping of the atomic bomb to what's happening in the Black community. They specifically reference it. And when I talked to Bobby about it, was it intentional? And he had said, of course, it was intentional. Everything that we, did was in an international framework. And that's why Kathleen and Eldridge Cleaver were invited to speak in Hiroshima. And if you read different, Black radicals during that time, whether it's a Kathleen Cleaver, Assata Shakur, and Angela Davis, some of these folks, you'll see a common thread, which is when Black or white, for that matter, when you grew up and you had to hide under your desk for fear of nuclear war, when you were seeing this all over the place, there was a real fear this was going to happen. It affects you in a way that, maybe gun violence affects a generation that came up now in schools. You can't. And so for a lot of those folks, that's what they it deeply influenced them, and they grew up with it and couldn't, it was something that really shook them to their core and molded who they became.
Well, I think we have time for maybe one last question, and I would bring us up to date in the particularly perilous times that we're in now. Because one thing that struck me in your book, you document over and over again, is the rift between activists who wanted to link everything together and those who did not. What do you think the lessons are for activists today?
Intersectionality is now the buzzword, that everybody likes to talk about and linking all these things. And I think that for organizers, you're always trying to thread this needle of not having an alphabet soup of every single cause at a rally or at a demonstration or, an action. And at the same time, understanding how these things are linked together. So you want to build coalitions. And so especially in the nuclear space, for me, I believe that people that have had the lived experiences and have been the victims of nuclear testing and things of this nature should be in the leadership positions of these organizations. And so I do think that there should be a linking of these things. I do believe in these in an intersectional approach. But again, I do also understand that you also have to be careful of not just lumping everything in. I've been in those circles when you're trying to organize something and who gets a speaking slot and how many groups want a part of this. And then do you bring in labor unions and do you bring in this group? And then that's the tough part of organizing, because then you have all these egos and you have all these different causes, and how do you put it all together to make it work? So, that this issue in particular is, does it become a larger issue of, say, militarism in general in war, or is it specifically nuclear weapons versus, say, conventional weapons? And that is a debate that goes on within right now, right? So, for example, if there was going to be a large anti-nuclear rally, is that the space where you bring in issues about immigration, issues about Palestine, issues about, now in one aspect you say, well, yeah, because it's all dealing with race and it's all dealing in some way with colonialism and it's all dealing with human rights, right? But what is the ask at the end of the day? What is the main goal? And so I think those are things that we're still trying to, figure out, and we're still trying to come to terms with. I can tell you that in the second book, where I looked at this issue in terms of the 1980s and anti-nuclear activism, a lot of the folks that organized in the 80s that back then were saying this should be a single issue and we should not deviate from it. Later, when I interviewed them, cut to, 30 years, 40 years later, now that they've had time to reflect, admitted to me that that was probably the wrong approach and that they should have tried to bring in more groups and they should have recognized the issue of race and colonialism and gender and class in this fight, and that, they could do it all over again. They see where that, has a place.
So then, if people want to read about Blacks in the bomb, or if they want to see some of your other writings, where should they go?
So easiest place is my website, which is just my name, vincentantandi.com. I'm pretty easy to find if you, online. You can also go to Oregon PSR's website and you can find all my information there. You know, I'm sure if you Google my name, any talks that I've done that are on YouTube will be available as well. So
That's Vincent Intondi, spelled Intondi when you go to Google him. Vin, thanks very much for coming on the Mole this morning. I really appreciate it.
well, thank you so much for having me and for all the great work that you do, and wish you the best of luck.
After the section with Coleman Hawkins and Charlie Parker, the rhythm section.